In August 2012, NASA landed its robotic rover named Curiosity onto the surface of Mars. You see there a little snapshot of its first year on the red planet, and it bore the name Curiosity. The reason it bore the name Curiosity was because of a high school student called Clara May, who won a competition to name the rover. She wrote, "Curiosity is the passion that drives us through our everyday lives. We've become explorers and scientists with our need to ask questions and to wonder." Some of you will remember that Dorothy Parker characteristically once said that love, curiosity, freckles, and doubt were the four things I could have been without. But nevertheless, both science and Christian faith in being curious about search for extraterrestrial intelligence have been a little ambivalent, a little fearful about it. Yet today, there are many voices around which want to explore what the consequences of the discovery of extraterrestrial intelligence might be. Martin Rees, our Astronomer Royal, calls it the greatest quest in modern scientific discovery. Of course, it's been backed with a fascination in popular culture with science fiction, and as I'll show in a moment, the growth in our discovery of exoplanets. Of course, there are many misleading myths around. In particular, that Christian faith would be somehow threatened by the discovery of extraterrestrial intelligence. Giordano Bruno was burnt at the stake in 1600, apparently, for belief in many worlds, although the truth of the matter is that he had a wide range of heretical beliefs. And Thomas Paine in The Age of Reason said, "He who comments on Christianity and the existence of other worlds may believe in both, but thinks little of either." That's two good people to start a talk with, Giordano Bruno and Thomas Paine, as we talk about the Christian engagement with extraterrestrial intelligence. But I want to suggest to you that the engagement actually is fruitful. And the engagement, although it has many unanswered questions to it, nevertheless is fruitful both for Christian faith and for SETI itself. Almost every day, there are news stories about different planets being discovered. If we think back, we'll see how revolutionary that is. It was only in 1995 that a Swiss team, using a radial velocity method, that is how a star wobbles as a planet exerts its gravity upon it, were able to discover the first planet around a main sequence star, not too far away. And we thought we might discover just a few. In fact, up to yesterday, we discovered over 1,800 planets around stars in over 1,000 systems, many of them being multiple planets. You see here a plot of the rate of discovery of planets from 1995 onwards. By the way, there are one or two points there which are pulsars and planets around pulsars, which were claimed earlier than this. And you see that most of the planets that have been discovered have been Jupiter mass planets, very big gas giants it seemed, but many around the size of the Earth. And using not just the radial velocity method, but Kepler's mission to note the way that the light curves drops as a planet moves in front of its star, or even gravitational microlensing, a fascinating piece of work which picks up planets by their gravitational lensing. What we've also been able to say is that some of these planets find themselves around the habitable zone. This is Kepler-69, and it's two planets, one a big gas giant right close to its own star. It'll be far too hot to sustain life, but one Earth-like planet, two or three times the size of the Earth, just in the habitable zone. A habitable zone where water is in liquid form, that's really important for the development of life. And it's these kind of discoveries, just in the last few years, that have encouraged that old argument which goes, there must be intelligent life elsewhere in the universe. It goes, well, if most stars have planets around them, and there are 100 billion stars in the Milky Way galaxy, and the Milky Way galaxy is one of 100 billion galaxies in the universe, then surely there must be other intelligent life elsewhere. It's a very powerful argument in the popular arena, but of course has to be balanced with other insights and other science that goes into this. One of them is that it might be life, but it may not be intelligent life. The Miliuri experiment of turning a few gases into amino acids, although widely now doubted, nevertheless gave the sense that the development of life would be very easy. The trouble is, of course, that to build from amino acids right through to accountants is really quite difficult. And you may have life, but you may not have intelligent life. It depends so much on the atmosphere. No comment on accountants in that. And so you may have lots of different life, but would it eventually move through to intelligent life? And even what do we mean by intelligence and consciousness as well? The other argument against was posed by Enrico Fermi at lunch in 1950. He and a number of physicists from Los Alamos had gone out to lunch, and they were talking about a cartoon in the New Yorker that day, which picked up two news stories in 1950. One was the observance of flying saucers. The second was the surprising disappearance of trash cans in New York City. And this cartoon combined the two. And so they were having a bit of fun about flying saucers. And Fermi went into a deep silence as he characteristically calculated something in his mind. And then halfway through lunch simply said, "Where is everybody?" Became known as the Fermi paradox. That if life was being created, intelligent life civilizations develop, then surely they should have colonized the galaxy already. It's a pretty neat argument. You can work it out fairly easily. You take a civilization sending out self-replicating probes, for example, which then go on to other worlds. You can build in redundancy and all the rest of it. And how long would it take one civilization to colonize our galaxy? Well, the answer is 300 million years. That sounds a long time, but compared to the age of the galaxy of 10 billion years, that's really very short. So Fermi's paradox, if they existed, they would be here, stands as one of the main arguments against. Leo Szilard, Hungarian physicist, replied to Fermi, if they existed, they would be here, by saying they are here and they're Hungarians. That was his response to it. But nevertheless, for all of the scientific arguments, there is a sense in which folk still get carried away, and particularly what the implications might be for life elsewhere and Christian faith. For what it's worth, as you might expect me to say, in weighing all of this evidence, as an astrophysicist who has an interest in these things, my own guess is that we are alone as intelligent life in this galaxy. For me, I think the Fermi paradox is very powerful in that. That's not to say that there isn't lots of simple life, bacteria out there, but Star Trek isn't particularly interesting if it's to boldly go to find out even more bacteria. Doesn't quite work. If there is intelligent life, it could be in other galaxies, but that in itself is a difficulty. Raising the problem of communication. Say there is an intelligent civilization in one of our nearby neighbor galaxies, and they send a message saying, "Hello, is anyone there?" That message might take 2 million years to reach us. If we send a message back saying, "Yes, we're here, who are you?" That's another 2 million years for the message to get back. That's not an interesting conversation, really. Now, although one mocks that, the problem of actually discovering life, which even may be beyond the observable universe, is a fundamental problem in this area. Nevertheless, news stories like this appear all of the time. This appeared 2 days ago on the web, that the Pope was about to make a declaration on extraterrestrial life. I have it from good authority that the Pope is not about to do this at all. This story is completely made up. But it shows the kind of interest that's around at the moment and what this might mean for religious belief and Christian faith. The history of the engagement of faith and the question of other worlds goes back throughout Christian history. Christian Huygens and Richard Bentley, when they began to see just how big the universe was, and they didn't see it in the way that Hubble sees it here, but nevertheless, when they began to see distant galaxies, used a theological argument for why there should be intelligent life elsewhere in the universe. They said, the universe is so big, there are parts of the universe we are, as human beings, are never going to see. Psalm 19, the heavens declare the glory of God. How might God's glory be seen by those things that human beings will never see? Well, there must be intelligent life elsewhere in the universe, they concluded. I don't commend the theology of that argument to you, but nevertheless, it shows a deep engagement of the question of other worlds. And the question of other worlds has worked out in a theological tension over many centuries. Here's Huygens and his telescope, pointing it into the sky, held together by a bit of string or a bit of rope. And he was having to battle against Aristotle. Aquinas had baptized Aristotle into Christian theology. And you remember that the Aristotelian universe had this earth at the center of everything. Therefore, other worlds elsewhere, they didn't fit with that picture. And then some Christians were worried that if there were other worlds, that would somehow undermine human status. And then other Christians said, well, how do we understand original sin? How might the sin of Adam be passed on to life elsewhere in the universe? And what about salvation? What about the Jesus event? These things were around from the earliest days and are still around today. But there was another tradition within Christian theology that was much more positive about other worlds. It was motivated by the belief that if God was truly the creator of the universe, he was free to create as, where, and how he wanted to. And that by imposing the Aristotelian universe upon God, limited God's freedom. And then Christians were struck by the extravagance of the creator God in Genesis 1 and said, well, maybe other worlds are just part of God's extravagant creation. And then Christians said, well, perhaps our unique special status is determined not by our place in the universe, but by the gift of relationship. The laws are universal because this is God of the whole universe, and therefore the laws that produced life here might do it again elsewhere in the universe. And Huygens, Bentley, and others began to say, as Galileo had said, in order to truly answer the question whether there are worlds, you had to look at the universe. The importance of observation, the centrality in the scientific revolution, motivated, as many of us believe, by Christian theology, to look at the universe. And you remember Thomas Cassini's rather clever but aggressive attack on Galileo. Cassini took some words from the Acts of the Apostles and used a wordplay to attack Galileo by saying, "You man of Galilee, why do you stand gazing up in the heavens?" Cassini was saying, you can work out the universe from Aristotle and from logic. You don't need to gaze at the heavens. But as the scientific revolution took over and people began to say, yes, we do need to look at the heavens, so Christian faith began to embrace again other worlds. There have been those who've given their voice to some of the interaction of SETI and faith. We can move through these quite quickly, I think. Paul Davis talks about how the discovery of other life in the universe would enhance the evidence for cosmic design. If life is widespread in the universe, it gives us more, not less, reason to believe in cosmic design. At the other extreme, Jill Tarter at the SETI Institute, one of the leaders in SETI, says that long-lived extraterrestrials either never had or have outgrown organized religion. If we did encounter other intelligent life, their religions would be far greater than the primitive religions of Christianity and Earth religions. A fundamental misunderstanding of the nature of revealed religion. She sees it as philosophical development. And then, of course, There's been those who have argued, is God an alien, from Eric von Daniken to Blumrich's The Spaceships of Ezekiel. Even a paper published in the Quarterly Journal of the Royal Astronomical Society a couple of decades ago by Edward Harrison argued that, in fact, the universe, its fine-tuning, was not because of God, but because it had been created by aliens in another universe. So it's still there, this type of argument. But I want to focus in the last few minutes that I've got on those who've said, particularly Paul Davis, would this be the end for Christian faith? Or how do you understand creation and redemption incarnation in this context? Well, I don't think creation's too much of an issue, to be honest. Remember, we talked about Aristotle and Colin Russell, a great voice in Christians of Science, a number of years ago pointed out that it was because of the Christian understanding that we are special because of the gift of grace given by God to us, God reaching out to us, the relationship of love. It wasn't our place in the universe that made us special. It was because God had reached out to us in creation and in redemption that made us special. And so the Aristotelian world that locates us at the center of the universe to make us special is not one that Christians need to adopt. The question of how the Jesus event relates to other life elsewhere in the universe, particularly intelligent life, is a little more complex and has been the source of some Christian discussion over the years. Arthur Peacock said, "Does not the mere possibility of extraterrestrial life render nonsensical all the superlative claims made by the Christian church about the significance of Jesus?" Something that one or two folk have argued. Well, E.A. Milne, the great Oxford cosmologist, took a view that the Jesus event should be once for all for the whole universe. He said, "God's most notable intervention in the actual historical process, according to the Christian outlook, was the incarnation. Was this a unique event, or has it been reenacted on each of a countless number of planets? The Christian would recoil in horror from such a conclusion. We cannot imagine the Son of God suffering vicariously on each of a myriad of planets." So for Milne, it's once for all. The trouble is, he's then forced into the position that Christians should become cosmic missionaries. And that's a very long missionary journey, by the way. E.L. Maskell, in his 1956 Bampton Lectures, opposed this view and said, "If there are in some part or other parts of the universe rational corporal beings who have sinned and are in the need of redemption, for those beings and for their salvation, the Son of God has united, or one day will unite, his divine person to their nature as he has united it to ours." And you'll know that some Christian hymns, like A Christmas Carol by a man called Sidney Carter, reflect this view of many incarnations on other worlds. The difficulty with that is, there are one or two. It may sound attractive, but one begins to ask questions, as other Christians have done, which is, if God becomes incarnate on other planets, why has God not become incarnate in other cultures on the earth? And then incarnation is not the only form of communication that God uses within Scripture. It may be central to the biblical narrative, but could God communicate in other ways on other planets? And then the most difficult thing to unravel, which was picked up by C.S. Lewis, you remember, in much of his science fiction, and that is, if there were intelligent beings on other planets, would they have sinned in the same way that human beings have sinned? Because our encounter with Jesus, incarnation, is not just about God showing us who he is, communication, but also his redemptive work, taking us out of sin, forgiving sin, conquering sin. Origen, one of the church fathers, presented a different picture, and he said, perhaps Christ's redemptive work is a transcendent action which gradually through time takes effect in every realm of creation, but which nevertheless needs to find corporeal expression in a particular place on a particular occasion, that is Calvary. Wolfhard Pannenberg takes a similar view. I'm a little unclear in my own view on this. John Polkinghorne, who was once asked about this, whether God became incarnate on other planets, said, "If little green men on Mars need saving, well, I don't know whether God will take on little green flesh, but he will do what is necessary." I think that's a pretty good response to it. So I'm relaxed about the discovery of SETI. Ted Peters, in surveys that he's done, has shown that most people actually within the faith communities are fairly relaxed. Although Peters' work is interesting in that it says that those outside the faith communities think that we Christians are going to have problems, even if us Christians say that we don't. Perhaps I come back to what we heard this morning. The value of this for Christians is just a reminder that at times our God is too small. John Wesley in 1765 was asked about this and found himself in the midst of controversy about other worlds. His simple advice was, be not so positive. Keep an open mind to it. And I think that's probably a good place to stop. That's been one of the responses to the Fermi paradox, that actually we are the first generation and there may be other life elsewhere. The difficulty with that is that the first generation of stars were very large stars and they go through their life cycle quite quickly. So in terms of comparison with the age of the galaxy, it's seeded quite early. Now, nevertheless, there's an element to which one has to take that kind of point quite seriously. It is early for us. But the timescales that we're still talking about are very large.
We Christians believe that there is a huge universe, in other words, the invisible universe with myriads of angels. Why should we worry about a tiny universe we have here, which may be a dot in the whole schema of God? Why should we worry about that? We haven't.
Well, I think that's right, although I think as Christians, we need to take into account the kind of questions that people pose for the Christian faith. Whenever I give a talk on astronomy and faith, I can guarantee two questions. One is about, is there life elsewhere in the universe? Subtext, is that a problem for Christian faith? The second is about the end of the universe, but that's another story as well. So I think there's something about us taking seriously those kind of questions. I think it's also that this is a really exciting time for science in this area. And that thrills me. As a Christian, I want to support it, I want to affirm it and encourage it, because, you know, this is the old Kepler thing, this is thinking God's thoughts after him. And just as I discover the extravagance of God in so many ways through science, the discovery of other life for me would be more of that extravagance of God's creation. Oh, absolutely. And there's a sense of perspective in all of this. And that's why I think those who've... Fred Hoyle in 1949 wrote a paper where he said that the motive for many people speculating about extraterrestrial intelligence was some sense that there is something out there to save us from ourselves. And so I think a lot of people and some of the new cults have focused their spirituality and hope for a savior into extraterrestrial myths and narratives. Whereas we as Christians have to say, well, actually, no, we do believe that Christ is Lord of all. And therefore, just as Paul in Colossians, you know, as we heard this morning, Colossians, you get all of this belief in intermediary powers and principalities and powers. And Paul's argument is Christ is the one that we need to take seriously. Well, the zoo hypothesis and the quarantine has been one of the responses to Fermi, and Carl Sagan and others pursued that, talking about it a lot. But actually, on the Earth going to be destroyed or the universe going to be destroyed, I think actually, I think the biblical picture is that this universe will be transformed into a new heaven and a new earth.
Interesting.
Stanley Yackey, a Roman Catholic theologian, says that when the little green women and the little green men land, we Christians should be the first to greet them because we would have something in common with everyone in the universe. And that's this belief and experience of God.
There's somebody else on the next.